Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Vision, and excuse the interruption, but this can't wait. It's news that's inspiring, bold, and great. We are back. The moment is here. The Vision Convention 2025 is crystal clear, a weekend that's vital to our recovery, full of light, truth, and real discovery. November 7th, 8th, and 9th, it's all going down in Newark, New Jersey, at the Marriott by the airport in town. It's more soul, where fellowship lifts us, the 12 steps get us whole, a chance to connect, to share and report, a space where we gather and speak heart to heart. If you came in 2019, then you already know the energy's high and the tickets will go. We sold out last time. Don't miss your shot. Save your seat now. This gathering's hot. For all the details and your golden invite, go to vision4you.info and register right. Get ready to grow, be seen, and be free. It's vital to our recovery. Just come and be. If funds are tight, never fear. Call Ken P. to get a scholarship here. And Ken's number is 434-960-8105. To volunteer service, if you're able, contact Allison L. and she'll set you up at a table. And Allison's number is 937-418-3167. See you there, everybody.
Thanks so much, Lynn. Appreciate you. I'm going to give those numbers again if you were jotting them down. Ken is at 434-960-8105. That's for the scholarships. 434-960-8105. And Allison on the service end of things, 937-418-3167. And just want to welcome everyone this morning to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay from Chicago, and I will be the host for the presentation this morning, which is Sunday, September 28th, 2025. And let me first give you the share ID numbers for Friday, September 26th. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 22,821. That's 22821. And the Friday, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, 22,822. That's 22822. So this morning, A Vision for You presents A Different Angle Changes the Whole Picture. You know, we may ask, you know, why do I eat compulsively? And I would suggest to you that the why doesn't particularly matter. Food does something for me. It produces an effect. And the binge substances make me feel great. And they make me feel great for a few moments. And our text, Alcoholics Anonymous, that we affectionately refer to as the Big Book, it tells us that we have a twist of the mind and an allergy of the body. And I'm reminded of all the people who are searching for the why. They're searching for answers. And I was certainly one of them. And I also, it's unfortunate to note, but it's certainly true for me. I've known many people who have died of this disease while searching for the why. You know, I had to stop the forensic analysis, and the Big Book clearly states that the main problem, of course, centers in the mind rather than the body. So those pills and potions and schemes and other things wouldn't work for a person like me. They may work for normal men, but I'm not normal in many ways. But because if the main problem centered in my body, then weight loss schemes and diets would work, and they don't. And if the main problem centered in my body, then, you know, a health club membership would be the answer for someone like me, but it just wasn't, and it isn't. And if the main problem centered in my body, then, you know, the treatment centers that sober folks up would churn out one recovered addict after another recovered addict, and they don't. But what if I could find a way to live where my mind comes at once by taking a few bites of my binge substances? You know, what if I could find a way to live where I'm no longer under the shadow of isolation, you know, that self-made prison of secrets and lies. You know, what if there was a way of life where I already feel better, rendering the food powerless over me? And then we have a process for that, process for bringing God into the equation that interrupts the disease, and that process is called recovery. And the blueprint for how to work the steps, well, it's laid out in the first 164 pages of our text. And what unfolds, we become unshackled from this merciless obsession. And now we have a workable method of living that is sustainable, that, you know, we've crossed the bridge to freedom. So joining us this morning to share her personal experience and insights of this sort of transformation is Chanel T. And Chanel is a recovered compostable reader from the state of Washington. And she is dedicated to the 12-step way of life and carrying a message of hope to our fellowship. And so it's with sincere gratitude and appreciation that we welcome her to the line this morning. Good morning, Chanel.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for all your service to A Vision for You and OA as a whole. This meeting, gosh, the big book, Overeaters Anonymous, all part of my higher power's rescue mission. I was just thinking about that. That saves my life every day. And I love getting to be here with you today. Hi, everybody. I'm Chanel T. from Washington State. Grateful and recovered compulsive eater today by the grace of God. I'm really excited to be here with you and talk about how a different angle changes the whole picture. About how laying down my ideas and expectations on the daily makes room for an ongoing spiritual transformation via the 12 steps. I'm going to give a little intro as an appetizer, very little, and then get into the meat of it, the main course of the 12 steps. I hope that resonates. Also, my experience is mine. My opinions are mine. If anything I say doesn't agree with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the book that's right. Very quick stats. My abstinence date is January 18th of 2023, just a little over 2.5 years. And the weight release is a little over 100 pounds. But I've got to tell you, entire abstinence and weight loss, or restoration if someone's underweight, they're essential. They're the least of the gifts, the miracles, the promises I get to enjoy every day. Life isn't perfect, but I get to live in recovery no matter what. And that keeps me working the steps no matter what. I'm not cured. I'm always going to be a compulsive eater. I'll always have this progressive disease that, left untreated or undertreated, would kill me. What I get today is a daily reprieve by working the 12 steps as laid out in the big book. And notably, with my higher power doing all the heavy lifting, is freedom from the bondage of food. It's freedom today from desperately seeking that elusive effect, which gives me a sense of ease and comfort, as Dr. Silkworth beautifully explains in The Doctor's Opinion, my favorite chapter, starting on page XXVIII. Never before January 18th of 2023 did I have food neutrality, and I didn't have it then. I got it from working the steps and God doing what God does that I can't explain. I was never even entirely abstinent, partly abstinent, anything abstinent before. And being honest, I wasn't trying to be. For every fleeting moment of relief through the foods and food behaviors, and that's a relief that never lasts long, fleeting, I was being numbed so I didn't have to feel the feelings, or just so I could face life as it really is. And I paid. I paid with hours, days, weeks, years of remorse, shame, self-loathing. I hated myself. My relationship with food and food behaviors in this disease is an abusive one, where in my own voice, the disease tells me, this time it'll be different.
I won't eat as much, but then I eat even more. Or sometimes for me, the voice says, it'll be okay to go without food or exercise like a maniac, and I won't hurt myself. But I did. The obsession, the twist of my mind is in my own voice. And the price isn't just physical. The disease takes its toll, its expensive, life-draining toll, if left untreated or undertreated. That's depressing. Can I just thank Jim Gaffigan for a second, the comedian? Maybe you've heard of him. I don't know him, but he gets me when it comes to food. Whenever I talk about the shame I felt as a compulsive eater, the hiding, isolation, the lying to myself and others, oh, so many lies. I think of one of his bits about fast food places. He said something like, oh, and I'm going to butcher it. They know we're embarrassed. That's why they invented the drive-thru. Look, no one has to know. Just drive around back and we'll hand it out the window. Yeah, I've lived that. So here we are at the main course. A fellow I love texted me saying, a different angle changes the whole picture. Wow. I'm not meaning different poses to look thinner, younger, more likable on Instagram. That's superficial change. No, I'm talking about how taking on a new perspective by laying down my old ones transforms me and how I live, where common sense thus becomes uncommon sense, from Bill's story on page 13. I'll quickly note pages here. Just know every part of the solution I discuss, the changing, the whole picture, that's going to refer to the big book of AA and rely heavily on higher power. First up in shifting perspective, food isn't my problem, it's my solution. What? I always thought I had a food problem. I thought I ate too much, needed to diet better, or at least work out more and occasionally not eat anything so I could binge at other times with impunity. I also believe, that's my angle all the way, that once I controlled my food by dieting, lost the weight, got to a certain gene size, which I'm going to let you in on a secret, in my sick head, that's at least two sizes more than healthy, everything else would fall into place. We all know how this story went. I did it so many times. Always the same. I would get to that weight or size, but still be unhappy, still be unsatisfied, whatever the number on the scale or my genes. No matter how I looked outside, I was still me. I was still not okay inside. I was still in bondage, still not free. From my angle, I never wanted to be like a normal eater. I just wanted to eat whatever, whenever, and however I felt like without consequence. Powerlessness, come on. I could diet like a champ, restrict like the best of them, overexercise like crazy. I could have won medals. You know what I won? Misery. Talk about a paradigm shift. Here we go. The food isn't my problem, but being stuck in it sure makes my life unmanageable. And I'm powerless over food and food behaviors. Step one. I add the food behaviors part because I find that those can trip me up too. That's why I have it there. It's listed, of course, in the steps as powerless over food. I'm powerless over food, right? Okay, just in case anyone's stickler on that, I hear you. How does that add up? Because I have no power, no choice over what happens once certain foods or ingredients pass my lips. And I have no say that they will trigger the phenomenon of craving. Again, from the doctor's opinion on XXVIII, an adverse or allergic reaction where I'm going to crave more. All right, that's cool, and why can't I just stop eating those things and stay stopped? Larry talked about that. Why can't I just stay abstinent by knowing what to eat and not eat and move on with life? Thank you, next. That's the obsession part where my brain tells me it's all right to eat those foods and not do, and it's all right to do those food behaviors too. It tells me I don't even have this disease, or that I deserve to eat that thing this time, or somebody made it for me and it would be rude not to eat it, or whatever nonsense I'm peddling that day. All the lies I tell myself because my real problem centers in my mind. I forget what happens every time, so I pick up again and I'm stuck in that loop over and over from There Is a Solution, pages 23 and 24. I used to say that food is my drug of choice. I don't know if any of you used to say that, but I said it all the time. Now I know I have none because I'm powerless. Without another solution, a spiritual solution that transforms the way I live, that changes the whole picture, the mental twist will always win, and I will always go back to the food and food behaviors. I cannot, by my own power, stay stopped. Do you remember that game Twister? Is that even still around? It was a silly party game where people would twist themselves around pretzels, around each other, actually, but we'd be like pretzels, fall down. That's exactly what my brain does when I try to figure out, and here's my next angle. How can I be powerless and yet empowered at the same time? I'm powerless, but there is a power greater than me who can and will restore me to sanity. Step two. I'm not sure I was ever sane in the first place, but that's another topic for another time. Noting this isn't a promise of higher power giving me abstinence or a healthy weight. Those things are vital, but not what step two says at all. It's a promise that my higher power will restore me to sanity if I put down all the foods and behaviors that trigger me, put down my ways, my will, and work the steps every day like my life depends on it. My higher power shows up and does all the rest. Okay, story time. The whole God thing wasn't my jam. It took going to meetings back in the mid-90s for an addiction I don't have so that I could be with the boyfriend in the beverage program, but really with the free binge foods they always had at those meetings. I would sit in the back of the room reading along in the big book until intermission when most of the group went outside and took solace in cigarettes. Well, I took solace in free binge foods they had in the kitchen. Coincidence or God incidents, or as some like to say, is it odd or is it God? As I listened and followed along in the big book, I kept hearing about this higher power. It actually sounded kind, loving, trustworthy, constant, on my side. I didn't believe in God at all, but figured that if there was one, he sure didn't like me. But it was at one of those meetings I got so intrigued about this, and I mustered the courage to talk with a couple of women in the parking lot after the meeting. One of the ladies told me she belonged to a church and invited me to come if I ever felt like it. No pressure, no hard sell. I heard her say, belong. That hit hard. I so wanted that. Other than in orchestras and symphonies growing up, I never ever felt like I belonged anywhere. That's a characteristic of this disease for me, for sure. Isolation, loneliness. I wanted, needed to be a part of instead of apart from. Remind me later to tell you how I feel in the fellowship here in LA. Okay, talk about changing the whole picture. This Book for Drunks brought me from a firm disbelief to a personal relationship with a higher power who loves me. I was still face down in the food and behaviors for almost 3 decades after that. But I look at this as the beginning of God's rescue mission. At least it's the beginning I can trace. All right, coming back to this main course from powerless to empowerment, it's also about my higher power being an inner resource I can access all the time, a power that isn't made by me, but is inside and working for and through me. Talk about a twister, mind twister. That's from Appendix 2, The Spiritual Experience, page 567, 567. I could camp in this mystery and never solve it. just like so much of the 12-step way of life, I can't explain why it works. Heard Larry say that too, right? Can't explain why. I only know it does. I figure not knowing why helps me be humble, right-sized in how I see myself. I don't come by humility naturally. Humiliation, sure, but not humility. My ego is either telling me I'm nothing but junk, a waste of air and space, or that I should be wearing a crown and a sash, surrounded by adoring applause. Even though I cannot take a snapshot that captures the why, I know these things are true. They're just as true now as they were when a group of hopeless, miraculously sober alcoholics published this book back in the 1930s. As page 60 in How It Works tells me, I can't, no human solution could, but God can and will if I come at this from a different angle, surrender my old ways, and grab onto what this program of recovery offers. Let's go. Next up for an altered angle. Surrender leads to freedom. Okay, that's another mind twister. But my will leads to destruction. My way leads to destruction. And I need to surrender to a power greater than myself if I want freedom from the bondage of food. I didn't buy that for a long time. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Make your own way. Aren't those mantras for a fulfilling life? I don't actually know, because I didn't really do that either. I lived my life as a victim, which I don't say to make light of trauma that many of us have gone through. I lived my life passively, sometimes passive-aggressively, if that's still a term. I let other people and circumstances be powers greater than me, all while trying to drive from the back seat and feeling sorry for myself when things didn't go my way. That's my default operating system. Rely on other people and circumstances, but don't really trust them. Try to manage, fix, control from the back seat. And when people or situations let me down by not meeting my expectations, then hold a grudge, feel sorry for myself, and eat over it, eat at them. To say I was always in collision with something or somebody, that I've lived in the fear and the resentment, would be massively understating it. That's from How It Works, starting on page 60. Thy will, not mine, be done. It's not just a nice religious catchphrase. It's actually a new way of looking at things that changes the whole picture. My way, my will leads to destruction. I was slowly, torturously killing myself, bite by bite, behavior by behavior. I was hurting myself and others in the process, not really showing up. I wasn't fully present for my daughter, friends, work, life. I wasn't fully present, period. What's the new angle? Surrender is deciding to turn my will and my life over to the care of a power greater than myself, step three. I nearly surrendered to this disease near the end of 2022. I knew I was spiritually dead, or at least near death. Activities of daily living, shoot, just getting out of bed hurt from the excess weight. And I wasn't suicidal then, but had been other times in my life. I just knew I wasn't really living, and worse, that I'd likely die young in my addiction, this disease. Thank God some small part of me, some little tiny part of me still wanted to live. Ask me another time if you want all the details of my slow and reluctant return to OA. I was here before. I was here in 2016 to 2017. I just wanted y'all to help me diet with group support for free. When I got to steps 2 and 3 in January of 2023, I believed in an all-powerful God. I just didn't believe that God would restore me to sanity. Terminally unique. My sponsor, smart person that she is, suggested I had two options. I could either go back to what I was doing before or suspend my disbelief, set aside the skepticism about whether or not God was for me, and work the steps as if waiting to happens. I'm forever grateful that she said it and that I went for door number two. It's one thing to believe in a higher power. I'm living proof that belief alone does not change the whole picture. Because I've had a God of my own understanding since 1995. I can believe all I want and never turn my will and my life over to the care of God. For decades, I refused to even so much as recognize that I kept God out of my food and food behaviors. That was my domain, my thing I held on to with a death grip, literally. I was trapped in self-will, self-centeredness, stubbornness. Surrendering my will and my life means letting God into my food. Obvious, simple, but not easy for me. To top it off, I couldn't do a thing about it, couldn't make the change by my own power. I had to have, and I still do, a higher power's help, which is talked about all over the big book, including How It Works, page 62. I had to get out of the way for any of this picture to change. I had to surrender. I hear all the time that the first three steps aren't action steps, and we're going to move on through the steps here as we talk about a different angle changes the whole picture. So technically, they're not action steps, but 1, 2, and 3 are foundational to recovery. I don't think that's said enough. It's every day. Every day I need to acknowledge. It's every day. It's a spiritual act to acknowledge that I'm powerless over food, to believe that a higher power will do for me what I cannot do for myself. There is a solution, page 25. And surrender my will and my life to that power. If I get loosey-goosey with any of these things, welcome to fast food heaven. What can I get started for you? That's in my near future. This disease progresses, and I must continue to work the steps with 1, 2, and 3, the foundation, the solid foundation every day. Here we go, jumping into a vigorous course of action, steps 4 through 9. I was not excited about it when I was doing it. I wasn't, yay, yay, rah, rah. I felt I was out of other ideas. I did have the gift of desperation, and I didn't want to find out what going back to the food would be like. This starts at the bottom of page 63 and how it works. Time for another paradigm shift. Even though I cannot change the past or determine the future, I've got to face, accept, and clean up the past and step away from the what ifs or the future of the future, right? In order to live free in the present and today. All the injustices, the true and exaggerated stories I've been telling myself and whoever would listen, the grudges and those, the fears, wow, I can live in those, let alone the harms I've done that I want to minimize or forget altogether. All those things clogged my mind, my spirit, my life force. I eat over and ate at memories and worries stuck in my head. You know how a catchy song plays at the store and burrows into your brain for days, whether you like the song or not? Make it years playing in a loop, and that's what living in the if-onlys and the what-ifs does to an addict like me, a compulsive eater. If I want freedom from the food and food behaviors, I've got to honestly and vigorously work steps 4 through 9. Yep, 10 through 12 as well, but first things first. All right, I was looking up jokes for step 4, and I'm not a joke teller. I'm just going to say what step 4 showed me. I was the problem I didn't know I had. I know step 4 seems like a big baddie, something to dread. But, and we're told that all the time. Not sure we're helping anybody by telling people that, but yeah, I hear it in the meetings a lot. But step 4 is really just a part of the clearing process. I'm thankful my sponsor didn't let me sit in it long, where I was really trying to stall, and I probably would have left. I don't know if I would have made it back. She had me read in the big book about step 4, listen to a podcast on it. There's several beautiful podcasts on A Vision for You on step 4. And get it down on paper with as few words as possible. No shade if your sponsor does it differently or if you do with sponsees. I'll say it for the people in the back. I don't know what anyone else needs. That's just what I needed. And it's the way step four looks to me when it's explained and how it works. To me, this is an angle shift because I'm a very wordy person, but it looks like a few words could still add up to a thorough inventory. I'm going to say it again. A few words could still add up to a thorough inventory. Resentments. Do you ever hear a fellow or sponsee say they don't have any? Or maybe they say it about fears. That always mystifies me. I think every human, let alone addict, gets resentful or afraid sometimes. They're natural things. That's going to happen sometimes, so I apologize in advance. As an addict, a compulsive eater, I cannot afford to hold on to these resentments, grudges, so that the sense of injustice plays over and over, the if only plays over and over in my head. Because that will lead me back to food, back to that slow and painful death. Page 66 of How It Works tells how holding on to anger blocks an addict like me from the sunlight of the spirit. I love that image. And that it's infinitely grave. I've got to get this junk on paper so the unclogging can commence. I must. And on page 67, fear is described as an evil and corroding thread. Shoot, why don't you say what you really mean, Bill W? It's powerful, and it's true. I do the same columns for fears as for resentments and pray afterward what God would have me be, from page 68. I'm going to be honest in step four, yet not write my memoir, another thing I would be tempted to do. And it's not psychotherapy either. It's inventory. And besides, I've lived in those first two columns, the who and the what and the cause, for years. I've been stuck there. I didn't realize, here's my story about this, I didn't realize how I wrapped my identity in what happened to me even more than the things that I did, that I felt, that I believed about the present moment. I didn't recognize. I built a stronghold meant to protect me that was actually walling me off from the world. And I could no longer separate myself, I'll probably get choked up over this, from the resentments or the fears. I dwelled in this prison of my own making, very lonely, isolated. The past hurts were under me. They were like a cold, cracked concrete floor. The fears over me as a gloomy, gunky ceiling. And the bars around me, those were my unmet expectations. So adding bars all the time and constant worries. That tiny window in my cell had the blinds mostly closed, keeping out much of the sunlight of the spirit. So I get my inventory down on paper, like it or not, looking not too long, but still thoroughly at how these things affect aspects of me, of myself. For column four, I prefer to ask, how is this resentment or fear still holding me in prison today? I wasn't, but someone who's abused as a child, they're not at fault for that. It's not really selfish to want not to be abused or neglected. But what's still blocking them here? What's the script they're carrying that wasn't followed? Selfishness. The story they hold on to that's not true, or they don't know if it's true. Dishonesty. They're self-seeking in this resentment or fear. And what's the fear now, today? Remind me to talk about the fear prayer on page 68. Then I go to my sex conduct, joy of joys, and every romantic relationship or situationship where I tried to make someone jealous, lied, cheated, or otherwise caused them harm, guilty on all fronts. I write it down just like I did with resentments and fears. I take inventory. I don't go into why I did it and how they hurt me more. This time I'm only looking at myself and examining what aspects of myself were involved in doing the harm, and where I was selfish, dishonest, resentful, and afraid. It also says inconsiderate. Page 69. Page 69 is an easy page number to remember here for some reason. There's another part of my sex conduct inventory also on that page. This is where I'm asking what God would have me be in relationships, the nerve, God's ideal for me. It's not my ideal of what someone else should do or be, but how I can show up where God is leading me. And I can't stress this enough. For me, it's ongoing. It's part of this transformation that makes a new picture. Doing a four-step inventory stirs up some icky emotions. Sick man's prayer on page 67 is great for the resentments. But being honest, I can get resentful when someone cuts the line in front of me at the store. So sometimes I need more than this prayer when the grudge is any deeper than that, which I'll go into, it's still in this book, when we get to steps 8 and 9. Here's another altered angle. Step 5 is a trustful. You know, when you did those little classes where somebody would stand with their arms open and you would fall backwards. I know we used to do that in PE as a partnership exercise. I seem to always get the person who wasn't paying attention. Anyway, I don't think this step or step 8 get enough credit. The 4-step inventory shows me the gunk and how I'm holding on to it. But step 5 begins the release, the clearing. It's extremely uncomfortable to share my yucky stuff with a sponsor, but it's necessary. Self-appraisal is insufficient. Into Action, page 72, tells me that. Worse, if I hold back anything here in my 5th step, the water will eventually break the dam and push me face down back in the food, page 73. And here's where a sponsor gets to be a huge help. I mean, all through the steps. Think is underrated. I learned personally as a sponsor to pray with the sponsee, then read pages 72 through the 2nd to the last paragraph, the 5th step promises, which are beautiful, on page 75 before she starts sharing. And her 5th step is an interactive process where I ask basic clarifying questions, guide her out of the story when she gets stuck there, or just encourage her when she seems to need it. I'm going to be gentle yet firm here. I want to let her know there's no judgment. And here's where I say, and it's true, I'm so selfish and self-centered, I'm going to think the harms I've done are worse anyway. This is a clearing process. It's part of it. And it's not therapy, not meant to be a codependent situation where I take on someone else's stuff. And I'm not equating therapy with codependence here. Not at all. Just want to make sure I say that. I need to keep the distinction in mind as a sponsor. I need to have a healthy amount of detachment and to pray up before and after hearing a 5th step. Can't stress that enough. I have to have my own release process so I don't borrow and hold on to things that weren't mine in the first place. After the sponsee shares her 1st step, I read the... after she shares her 5th step. Humility, right? After she shares her 5th step, I read the final page on page... Okay, you guys, I'm just going to take a moment. Deep breath, because I'm getting all tongue-tied out of my memory here. She shares her 5th step, and when she finishes, I read the final page on... Okay, it is a paragraph on page 75 to her while she reads along. Okay, tongue and mind, behave. The final paragraph on 75 gives instructions that say, go get quiet with God for an hour. Doesn't say 5 minutes, doesn't say 30. It's very specific. So I assign that to her. It's not meant to be something she does for days or days from now, at least not in my experience. She is to thank God and ask if there's anything she left out of her 4th step, and then add it if she did. I let her know that she'll share any additional inventory with me the next time we talk, right before we do 6 and 7 in our next conversation. And then I congratulate her, letting her know that everything she said will be kept between her, God, and me. I can't stress that enough. Somebody's been quite vulnerable with me. I want them to be able to feel they can trust me. Next up, a shift from, but I don't wanna, and it's not going to work for me, to I'll do it anyway. All shifts I've had to have over this time. It said succinctly on page 568, Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. If I want the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery, page 567, I must be willing, honest, open-minded as I do the work, the steps. And here's just a small example. If I want what my sponsor says, maybe I ought to try to do what she does. Steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, starting on page 76 of Into Action, continue the clearing process. And if done thoroughly, they complete it. I don't know why there are only two paragraphs and less than one devoted to 6, 7, and 8, respectively. All I know is that each one talks about willingness, and the Big Book says in multiple places that being willing is necessary for recovery. For me, steps 6 and 7 are ongoing. It's not a one and done. Really, nothing of this is. Nothing in the steps is. That's another topic for another time. I'm going to have continued changes, layers of my old ways, my old self being peeled away in my cooperation with my higher power. A sponsor said to me that the bad news is this disease is progressive. The good news is recovery is progressive. Working the steps is daily. It's a design for living. From there is a solution, page 28. Just as I keep working the steps each day, my higher power, my inner resource, keeps transforming me, changing the picture. And steps 6 and 7 are integral to that change. Once I stop holding on to whatever you want to call them, character defects, defenses, defaults, I can clear my part, steps 8 and 9, and cooperate with my higher power who's changing me. It's a bit scary to think about, and another mystery I can't solve. I just know it works. And here's my plug for step 8, and it's another angle shift. Step 8 is another trust fall. Since I've already seen that I can't do this by myself, I mean, I wouldn't be here working my tail off if I could. I trust fall into my higher powers and my sponsor's arms in step 8. As a sponsor, I'm prayerfully looking at the sponsee's harms list she shared with me, helping her put together her amends list. Now, I like to say to sponsee that everyone I harmed goes on the list, and my higher power sponsor and I will discuss who I make direct amends to. Again, it's not something I decide alone as the sponsee. Another thing I say to sponsees is, we're not going to harm someone again. If making a direct amends will further hurt them, not in my imagination, but by going to my higher power, getting higher powers leading my sponsor's input. If it'll hurt them again or harm someone adjacent to them, like the person's partner when I had an affair with him, we're not going to cause more damage. That's not the point of amends. And I don't clear my conscience by trampling someone else's needs or feelings. But what if someone did more harm to me than the other way around? That happens. At least in my mind, it does. How free do I want to be? My inventory and amends aren't about what they did to me. That's something I prayerfully set aside. And if I can't, if I'm not willing, as it says on page 76, I know I'm thumping that word today. I pray for the willingness. A little more story time. I wouldn't let go of a resentment toward one of my sisters-in-law, and it held me back from making an amends for quite a while. Someone in a Zoom meeting during the parking lot, I like parking lots, can you tell, talked about page 552. She read it and blew me away. Finally, there was a prayer I could use around deep resentments, around my bitterness that was blocking me and burning me from the inside. It's fondly called the Bless Them, Change Me prayer. When I suggest it to sponsees and fellows, which I do so often, it's probably annoying, we read it together. I love what the writer outlines here because it doesn't say I ever have to condone someone's behavior or even like them or have anything to do with them. The point of this prayer on 552, in my experience, is to do it faithfully, do it even though I don't mean it at first, until my perspective changes Without even realizing it, I began to see my sister-in-law as the wonderful wife and mother she is. I began to feel compassion toward her. I was finally able to make amends to her, and it was one of the most meaningful, powerful amends I've ever made. We're still not buddies. We're not going to hang out anytime soon. We don't have much in common. My brother passed away. His family lives far from Washington. But I don't hate her anymore. A hatred I carried for nearly 20 years. Doing the page 552 prayer for weeks, and in this case, because I owed one, making a direct amends, freed me from the bondage of that slow burn, fatal resentment. There's a bit more on step 8, and I'm going to segue into the 9th step. As a sponsor, I need to listen closely. Storytime, a sponsee mentioned a name on our amends list that I didn't clarify. I glossed over it somehow, which is not cool. Because I didn't catch it, she decided she'd make an amends to someone she never harmed. He caused her trauma when she was a child, and she insisted on making an amends for her part of the abuse. I don't owe amends for someone else's abuse or neglect or harm done to me. That's not on me. I can do the page 552 prayer for that person and release my resentment toward them for my own freedom, but it's not my amends to make. Lesson learned, paying close attention to sponsee's harms list is essential, or I could miss something important. Okay, on to step 9. Talk about a paradigm shift. Saying sorry isn't the same as making amends, and making amends isn't just about justifying my actions. To the first point, I said sorry for so long for just about everything. I heard a fellow share she used to apologize for existing. That resonates. With me, it was either apologizing for something that didn't even need it, or saying I'm sorry and doing the same thing. Wash, rinse, repeat. I express my regret for my actions when I make an amends. That's part of it. But I'm amending my behavior. Mend is in that word, not simply saying I'm sorry. I'm also not going to drag myself, say I'm a horrible person for doing the harm, even if what I did was objectively horrific. I'm going to be calm, frank, and open into action page 78, sticking to what I did, what I'm hoping to do to make it right. What I find helps me is writing out a script using a simple template, which we can discuss at another time. It is outlined in the big book. I let people know I'll be reading from it so that I stick to the points and cover everything. Now, this may be controversial, but I don't force amends on anyone, and I don't believe that's supported in the step 9 directions from the big book. I don't email, DM, or text amends either, and if I can't see someone in person for a realistic reason, I'll ask for a video call, but I'll settle for a phone conversation if that's what they're willing to do. They've got to be involved, though. They've got to be able to respond as they wish. If they're living and they're able to speak, they've got to be involved. And I'm speaking only for myself, but I would use email or text as a cop-out, as a way to either force the amends or not have to talk with them. So I don't suggest it. To the second point, making amends isn't about justifying my actions. The big book discusses this beautifully about not criticizing or arguing, not bringing up the other person's wrongs, pages 77 and 78. If I go to my daughter and say, you know how sometimes you're snippy or rude and I end up being snippy and rude back, I want to make an amends, blah, blah, blah. Yet that's not an amends, it's an excuse. I'm diminishing what I did by pointing at someone else's behavior. And as a sponsor, I need to catch that in sponsee's 9-step scripts. Step 9 is about clearing my side of the street with my higher powers and my sponsor's guidance prayerfully. I need to do it in order to recover. Okay, here we are in the home stretch, step 10. What's the different angle here? For me, it's the mystery of staying in recovery, yet having a daily reprieve. One of my mentors in the program used to say to me, she would say all the time, we haven't arrived at anything by working through the steps. We haven't arrived at anything. For a long time, I didn't get it. But recovery isn't about reaching the summit. It's about trudging the road of happy destiny. Page 164, A Vision for You. after I've had that spiritual awakening as it continues. Page 84 tells me that when I get to step 10, I need spot check inventories, which aren't the same as a nightly review. That's part of step 11. Doing these inventories as I clean up the past, as I'm doing my nines. Otherwise, I'd let all the resentments and fears pile up again and have to keep doing a long 4 through 9 process. That's no fun. And the point, according to pages 84 and 85, is to continue growing along spiritual lines, to continue living in recovery. There can be something deeper than a 10 once in a while, but most of the time, I can do a 10th step and take the edge off, get realigned with God, and move on with my life. Another quick story, 10th step promises on pages 84 and 85 were all I could handle and hold on to. And I did hold on to those while working steps 1 through 9. Because the other promises seemed too big. I figured food neutrality was the best thing I could experience here. And this is one time I'm glad to be wrong. All right, how do I do 10s? I'm glad you asked. I do them as I was shown, which is from the second full paragraph on page 84. It gives such simple instructions, basic. I don't see a reason to add to them or take away, but again, I don't know what anyone else needs. And if someone's new to doing 10-step calls with fellows, I share with them the magical phrase a mentor in this program gave me. She suggested, and I'm going to clear my throat again, she suggested saying to anyone who hasn't heard me do a 10 before, I'd love your feedback on everything except how I do my 10th step. If the other person ignores that, I gently interrupt and say, oh, thank you. I actually do it the way my sponsor taught me, so that's what I'm going to stick with for now. On that note, I suggest and request that sponsees do their 10s exactly and only as spelled out on page 84 every day for at least 30 days. They'll get accustomed to doing it that way, and then they can decide if they want to do it differently. No harm, no foul. I have them practice with me, and I usually give them names and numbers of people I know will take their 10-step calls and encourage them. Don't want to eat our young here. Encourage. Speak the truth, but encourage. For me, it isn't a graded exercise either. Nothing in this way of life is. And I'm such a student, I forget that sometimes, but I digress. Next up, and we're coming to the close quickly here, a different angle on self-knowledge fix it, which is in More About Alcoholism, page 40, till we realize we know only a little. God will constantly reveal more to you and to us. That sounds familiar. It's from A Vision for You, page 164. I don't get to coast here. Page 85 tells me that I have a daily reprieve contingent upon staying spiritually fit. What's that mean? For me, it means doing steps 10, 11, and 12 every day. And a step 10 involves working 4 through 9 for sure, at least. Step 11 is where I come to my higher power for relationship, where I practice my humility that God is God and no one else is, including me, pages 85 through 88. I could argue that doing regular 10 steps does that too. It realigns me with my higher power. If I'm in a friendship or a love relationship, back to step 11, I can only expect it to continue if I show up and take part in it regularly. And I wasn't much of a friend in the disease. I'm still learning to be one. Still mess up. Still make amends. We're getting close to the end here. Let's go. Because I want to hear your questions. Working steps 10, 11, and 12 changes my life for the better every day, as long as I make it a priority every day. I don't have an option about whether or not I'll work with others, step 12, as a sponsor, to put myself out there again and again and hope to give them what was given to me. That's page 89. Starts there in working with others. Here's a different angle for me with step 12. I sponsor first and foremost as a recovery insurance policy, and secondly, to help someone else. Here's the other thing. I'm not powerful enough or responsible for anyone else's recovery. It's not something I get to manage, fix, or control. I can want it more than they do, but that's fruitless, page 96. I can work with them and let them run the show, which is being disingenuous to my own program and not being a sponsor. Or I can make it into a codependent situation where I won't really be sponsoring them because I'm too busy making sure that they like me and I've made all these mistakes and more. There's a whole chapter devoted to sponsoring, and it wasn't called that then, sponsoring, but it's clearly what the chapter's discussing, along with a bit about carrying the message to other compulsive eaters beyond potential sponsees. I'd say the next three chapters, which I won't cover here, and I've heard them called the forgotten chapters, flesh out the message-carrying part even more. I don't have to want to sponsor today. Again, it's willingness. When I started working with others, I was petrified. I only did it at first because it's the only way to stay recovered and enjoy all the beautiful promises throughout this book. Now I like sponsoring most of the time. And I do it imperfectly all the time. Thank God for God, and that I'm not. So I've kept you quite a while, a little longer than I planned, actually. I'm going to wrap up with two of my favorite promises, and I'm quoting both. One is about step 12. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. From the forward to the second edition, page XVII. And this one is why I'm sharing with you today. It's from the forward to the fourth edition, page XXIV, the end of the forwards for now. Till we get a fifth edition, if we ever do. I keep wondering when we'll get it. In any meeting anywhere, AAs share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem, or face to face, AAs speak the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. Thanks for going on this journey with me, long and winding road, looking at how a different angle changes the whole picture. Now, I'm just another compulsive eater on the bus, sometimes singing off key, sometimes needing to be called out on my BS when I get off track. Today, I'm grateful for my higher power's grace, grateful for abstinence and recovery, grateful for all of you. And with that, I will pass.
Thank you so much, Chanel T. from Washington. Thank you for just such a clearly articulated, very relatable and hopeful message. We just our sincere appreciation to you. And I want to ask everyone to please stick around to the end of the meeting. If you'd like to get Chanel T's contact information, we'll ask her for that at the end of the recorded portion of the message this morning. Let me first provide the share ID for the presentation today before we transition to Q&A. That share ID is 22823. That's 22823. So now we'll transition to Q&A. If you have a question for Chanel, questions only, please press star one and give me your name. Who has a question for Chanel?
Jen B.
Okay, I heard, was that Jen? And then I heard Maura.
Michelle
okay,
M.
Who else? Hey, Michelle, thank you, gotcha. Who else?
Marisa G.
Marisa?
Ken W. H.
Hi, Ken, I gotcha. Anybody else? Question for Chanel. Okay, we'll catch you. We'll have plenty of time if you do have a question for her. Here's who I heard. I heard Jen, Maura, Michelle, Marisa, and Ken. Let's start with everyone, if everyone can mute other than Jen. And Jen, what's your question this morning? Good morning to you. Jen, press star one.
Hi, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now, Larry?
I can, Jen. Thanks so much.
Hi. Thank you, Chanel, for your message this morning. It's just the one that God meant for me to hear. Coming out of relapse on day 4, and this part was really huge for me, a reason for my relapse. He said, surrender leads to freedom, but my will leads to destruction, and that we can believe in God and never turn our will and our life over to him and let him into the food. I always thought I was letting God in, but I think I took it back immediately after I said it. So my question for you is, what does surrender look like to you? Like, how do you exactly surrender to him and let him into your food and do that trust fall that you were talking about?
Thanks for your question, Jen. And I'm glad you're here. Glad you're back. You know, I'm only going to speak from my own experience, of course, but everything about my abstinence is a spiritual practice. Everything about step one is a spiritual practice. I can say I'm powerless, but not really believe it or not really act like it. I personally, only speaking for me, weigh and measure. I pre-commit what I'm going to eat the next day, the night before, and I weigh and measure my food. And mine comes from a nutritionist because I had to fire myself as nutritionist, not saying that that needs to happen, but that's the properly appointed authority for me. Here's the thing, though. I could be abstinent without the nutritionist, and I was, but letting God in, because abstinence is the first part. I have to do that in order. We wouldn't go try to take a drunk person through the AA steps. So I'm not going to take myself, I'm not going to expect a spiritual awakening and to live in the promises if I'm drunk in the food, and you're acknowledging that. But what do I need to do to let God in? I need to set aside. So the surrender for me is daily setting aside what I think, what Chanel thinks, what I want, what I'm sure I deserve or don't deserve and therefore should punish myself, what so-and-so did to me then or is doing to me now. Or I've got to set everything down that is me when it comes to the food. And I've got to pay it down even more than I think I should when it comes to what triggers me. Because that'll come out in the wash. And I do that prayerfully. I actually use a tool to get clear on that. And you can contact me offline for what that is. It's people in this program doing it. I don't think it's an outside issue. But that's what I do. And I have to do it daily and just work all the steps. Just go through anyway. Do it anyway. I hope that helps. Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. Next question from Maura, followed by Michelle. Good morning, Maura.
Hey, Larry. Good morning. Thanks for your service, as always. Chanel, I wish I could write faster because there are such clear and precise pieces of wisdom and guidance in your share. I thank you so very much. My question is very short. You were speaking about steps 9 and 10, and you said recovery is not about reaching the summit. It's about, and I couldn't get the last piece of that. Do you recall by any chance what it was you were saying or what you were meaning?
I do, Maura, and it's about all the steps. And when I get into 10 and 11 and 12 and keep working the steps, but 10 and 11 in particular, if we want to name two steps. It's from 164. We read it on this meeting all the time. I'm not reaching a summit, as that mentor told me. I'm not arriving at something. It's not the destination. I'm actually trudging the road of happy destiny. That's what I said. Okay? I hope that's what I said. It's what I meant. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Maura. Thanks, Chanel. Okay, next up we have the question followed by Marisa. Michelle, good morning to you.
Well, good morning. This is Michelle M. Larry, thank you for your service. And Chanel, that was a beautiful, beautiful presentation. The shift in perspective is just a key to this program. But what I want to ask you is, I hear so many people talk about grace. And what does grace mean to you?
Wow, getting all these great questions, and I appreciate it. Thank you. People are thinking. I love it. Well, I'm only going to speak for myself, and you did ask me what it means to me. It's grace that got me here. It's grace that allows, you know, a higher power's grace that allows me to, now I'm not talking about abstinence here. I'm either abstinent or I'm not. You know, I'm either pregnant or I'm not. I'm either abstinent or I'm not. I'm either alive or I'm not. I'm talking about the rest of the program. I'm going to work it imperfectly. And grace comes in there. And also, I want to be a human being, not a human doing. We do a lot here. We do a lot of work here. And it's by God's grace that my higher power has been showing me. And, you know, I've got a pretty thick skull. Things don't get to me quickly a lot of the time. I get inside my head, except the stuff I think someone's doing to me. And that's in immediately. But the things about myself, I think I'm doing 100% of the work, or I think I'm doing 99% of the work of my recovery, because I'm doing a lot. But really, I'm doing probably less than 1% of it. It's all I can do, but it's probably less than 1%, and my higher power does all the rest. I think of that as grace for two reasons. One, I don't have to do as much as I think I'm going to have to do. I have to work the steps every day, but I don't have to be anything beyond me, and I am always going to be me and imperfect. And I think that's grace to be able to accept that, which I also do imperfectly. I hope that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle, for the question. And next up, we have Marisa, followed by Ken. Marisa, good morning to you.
Thank you for the opportunity. Jen pretty much asked the question I had about the different angle about surrender. Surrender is a tough word for me to put down, because I believe that surrender means that I don't want to continue in my recovery. But you angled it very well, so I'll ask another question. And you mentioned suspending your disbelief about higher power. Does that also include suspending your own belief in your ability to recover? Thank you very much.
Absolutely, Marisa, and thank you for the question. It absolutely does. And I was pretty much out of belief that anything could work for me. I've tried so many things. Maybe somebody here can relate to that. I tried so many ways to control the food, even to control my eating at a certain point. And I couldn't diet anymore successfully. Like I said, I'd been a champ. If there had been medals for it, I would have won some. But I'm suspending my disbelief that this can work if I surrender. And surrender is ongoing and uncomfortable. Here's the thing. I was already surrendering to the food and food behaviors every time. I just didn't want to acknowledge that. And I think I'll try to cover both of these things really quick. Surrender, I think of as weakness. That's my societally ingrained, probably, view of it. But it brings me freedom, because until I lay down everything that I've been doing with and in the food, there can't be the spiritual transformation. Because I'm blocking myself. I am serving a lower power. the food. I'm worshiping that. That's my idol. That's my end all be all. And I didn't ever want to admit that. And then suspending my disbelief and letting God in, or any concept of higher power. I know somebody who for a while had a pet rock and she decorated it and named it and called that her higher power. You know, whatever works for somebody. I've got to suspend disbelief and skepticism because I was so jaded here, so jaded long enough. And just, you know what? I can't, but my higher power can. I've got to do this. If I fully can just believe that and act as if it's going to work and just work it like my hair's on fire, as people like to say, like my life depends on it, which I think it does, then I'm going to get the results. It's promised. If it worked for a bunch of hopeless drunks back in the day and still does, then maybe I can just set aside my skepticism long enough to see that it works for me. I hope that answered your question. Call me if it didn't. Anybody, call me for any reason.
Thanks, Marisa, for the question. Before we go to Ken with the question here, just keep in mind, great opportunity to pose a question for Chanel, so be thinking about that. And next up is Ken. Hey, Ken, good morning.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Chanel. This is a good meeting, good share. Thank you. Appreciate it. Just a question, perhaps from a little bit different angle, just to keep it interesting. How is Step 10 not the same as Steps 4 through 9?
I like that. Make me think. Okay. I'm already in recovery in Step 10. That's the biggest part of it. I've had the spiritual awakening, which will continue. It'll continue. Doesn't mean that it's ta-da and that's it. It's ongoing. Step 10, I'm food neutral, or at least getting there soon, I hope. I was. Didn't even realize it, actually. But I'm living in some of these promises. I'm beginning to really feel them and experience them. So when I do a 10, part of it is that I'm starting to recognize and practice recognizing the annoyances, the fears that come up for me all the time. Me, Chanel, they come up all the time. When I hear people say they didn't have a 10, and I've tried that. Oh, I didn't have a 10 today. Yeah, that's not the truth for me. There's always something that bothers me in the day. And it's coming to more of an awareness than I had, because when I was in the 4 through 9 process, which takes a little looking at me in ways I didn't want to and that I wasn't used to doing, by the time I'm in step 10, well, I've kind of done that a bit. I'm a little bit more used to it. And I can start to develop a flow. And the other thing is that I start letting more people in. It says to discuss it with someone immediately. My sponsor was quite clear that wasn't going to be her most of the time in step 10. It forces me to reverse my way, you know, go against my way, which is be alone, thank you very much, and start calling people, start reaching out to people, start involving them in my recovery. So it's higher power, the other person, and me together on that call. I hope that answers the question. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Okay, we got a little bit more time. If you got a question for Chanel, please press star 1 and give me your first name.
8B.
Hey, Pete, gotcha. Who else? Maybe a couple more. Anybody else with a question for Chanel? Okay.
Ellen C.
Okay. Hey, Ellen. I got you down there.
Thank you.
All right. You bet. Let's go with that for now, and we'll see where we're at here. So let's start with the question from Pete. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for your service today. And Chanel, thank you for your presentation. Step one says, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. And in We Agnostics, it says lack of power, that was our dilemma. Why do you think it says those things in past tense?
That's a great question, Pete. Making me think, and I like it. I think it's important to see that this is part of the mystery for me. And anybody who's also in the beverage program does know the big book better than I do at this point. I'm going to be honest here. But when I read these things, my experience is that I was, when I was face down in the food, powerless, and lack of power was my dilemma. Now, not in the food, in recovery, I still got to acknowledge that the disease is progressing no matter what behind the scenes. It's still there. You hear people say it's doing push-ups in the parking lot, whatever you want to say. It's still, it's the man of 30 where he put down, that's in More About Alcoholism, as everybody here knows. It's, he put down the alcohol for 25 years. But then when he had no problem, apparently it doesn't tell how he acted the rest of that time, but he put it down. So it should have been past tense. Whether he brought in a higher power or not, I don't know. It doesn't really say that, so I don't assume that he did. But then once he picked it up again, which I believe firmly, if I were to do, even after working the steps, if I just started playing around with my foods and letting it slip a little here, for example, wasn't doing my work, wasn't sponsoring or at least attempting to sponsor. A lot of people jump off from working with me, but with those who do, I believe that like the man of 30, who once he picked up, it was, and he was dead in 4 years, I think. I believe that's what it means when it's past tense, but it's still there for me. If that doesn't make sense, somebody ask me for clarification now, and I'll try.
All right. Thanks for the question, Pete. And next up, Ellen, good morning to you. Ellen, press star one.
Good. Thank you, talking to myself. Chanel, thank
I
you
do
so
that
much.
All the time.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Chanel, how did you deal with, or if it's not your experience, how do you help others deal with parental neglect and abuse? They're adults now and parents are gone. How do you help others or dealt with yourself dealing with that?
Yeah, thank you, Ellen, for the question. You know, I'm not going to be their therapist, even if I were a therapist, was a therapist, which I'm not. I'm not going to be their therapist. That's something that I need to remember because I want to make everything better for the other person. I want there to be peace. I want everybody to be peace, love, and happiness. That's my nature because then it's more comfortable for me. And one of the things is that's a real thing, and I'm going to acknowledge and say, I'm sorry that happened to you. I am so sorry that happened to you. And there are outside things they can do to get some help and deeper level for that, but I'm not going to discuss that here because we're talking about 12-step program. That is an outside issue. What I do is I handle that like anything else in the sense that I'm going to say to them, hey, you know, one thing I'll never be is your therapist, and I don't want to ever come across like I think I am. And I'm not telling them they need one either. I just want them to be sure and be clear of that distinction. I don't want them to go into the story. They've done enough of that and ate over it for years. So I want to acknowledge, okay, that's happened. That's real. It's a major part of their lives. But get them from that story, which they're never going to forget, and I'm not telling them to as much release as they can do in program to not eat again, to not pick up again. And that's where that page 552 prayer comes in really nicely for a lot of people. I like it. And also just acknowledging, oh, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And of course, and then not allowing them to take on any blame for it because they've done that all those years too. I'm going to redirect them anytime they start talking about, well, and I've had that with sponsees and fellows. You know, okay, no, it's, would you think another child was at fault if they were abused or neglected? Oh, of course not. Well, you're not at fault. You're not at fault for what was done to you. That's abuse, neglect. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you so much for the question. Chanel, I'm going to give a last opportunity in case someone wants to pose a question. Anybody else before we wrap up here?
Alita J.
Okay, let's try that with Alita. And then, I promise, we'll close from here. Okay, Alita, what question do you have?
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Chanel, for your very full and informative share. I enjoyed it, and I feel inspired by it. I know that religion and politics are outside issues. However, this is a spiritual program, so, you know, sometimes, I don't know. My question, you can tell me that it's not appropriate if you want, but or if it is inappropriate. But my question is, how do you navigate through program? Our program accepts all beliefs. How do you navigate and practice patience, tolerance, and love with people in program who have totally different spiritual leanings than you, and maybe do you totally not talk to them if they're, you know, if they call you, do you avoid the conversation, or do you talk with them? Or I haven't found a way. I've prayed about this. I've tried for years to practice tolerance and patience, but I get stumble on this one. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I just want to clarify, are you Alita with a T or Alisa with an S? If you can star one, let me know.
With a T.
Okay, thank you, Alita. Yeah, you know, I have my own beliefs, and I think most people have beliefs. I don't know how we would be human and not. And one of the things I don't do typically is get into political conversations with people, because you did mention that at the beginning. I don't do that here. That is I have before, but it's just not a great place for me to go. This is when I call someone in program or take a call in program. It's a solution-focused call, and I can't solve political stuff, and I can't change their beliefs. And to that point, one of the beautiful things for me about this program is that it doesn't give dogma. It doesn't say, I have to believe a certain way. I can have my faith in the higher power of my own understanding, and you can have the faith in yours. I think that's a beautiful thing, because it opens the door for everyone. I have very specific beliefs that are my faith tradition, and someone can call me who is an atheist, no judgment. Why? Because we have the same spiritual malady, and I'm not going to be forcing them to believe what I believe. I can't do that. I can't force someone to do anything, really, when it comes to what happens in their mind and their heart. And I like the tolerance portion, because I can be quite judgmental. And here in this program, it's my job, I think, to not be toward other people, to be kind, to be loving, because it's a program of attraction rather than promotion. And I think of it the same way. If I promote, push my beliefs on everybody else, That's why I say I don't know what anybody else needs, because I don't. If I do that, or I'm doing that in my mind when they're talking to me and I'm getting all riled up, who's that helping? It's not helping me, and I'm not really there for them. And it, to answer to your question, I worked through the steps. A couple kinds of things when I was working through 4 through 9 came up. And if something really bugs me in a conversation with somebody, I can go do a 10 step on it where there's no way anybody knows who I'm talking about. I have to be respectful of anonymity. I can do that, because then I'm bringing God in with prayer, and I'm also discussing it with another fellow, calling myself out on it, not trashing myself. I hope that helps. Thank you.
Thank you, Alita. And thank you, Chanel, so much. Just a wonderful contribution for the archives, and we're so appreciative of your time this morning. So thank you once again. Let me give you the share ID number again for the presentation this morning. That number is 22,823. That's 22823. We're now going to close with a reading from the Big Book on page 164. And then we will get we will get Chanel's contact information. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.